Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. It is an absolute joy to be joined by Armando Iannucci, the man behind On the Hour, the day-to-day, Saturday Night Armistice, the Armando Iannucci shows, Alan Partridge, The Thick of It, In the Loop, Time Trumpet, Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle, Veep, Death of Stalin. Armando, is there anything that you've done which was rubbish?
Well, I'll leave that for others to say. Does that sound like a politician's answer?
It is a little bit of a politician's answer.
That's a rubbish policy.
You have had an extraordinary... There were loads of people who'd be happy to have been involved in one of those shows. Never mind, what was it, a dozen?
I have a constant... I remember once talking to some sixth formers and you get really great questions from when you go around schools, actually. Questions that journalists don't ask. And the first question I got was, when you start a new project, how do you overcome your fear of failure? And it kind of completely floored me. And I had to think. And the answer is, I go into each project assuming it's my first one, or pretending it's my first one, because you've got to go into it with the passion and vigour and concentration that you do when you're starting out. So I tend to, irrespective of what the last project was, forget it never happened, pretend it never happened, so that you're not... So that you're not in any danger of sort of coasting, of doing the same thing twice.
The interesting thing about the way that you work, we'll come on to Avenue 5 in a moment, but you're not someone who, sort of a normal career path, is someone who was really involved in the writing and all of that at the beginning, and then gradually they become increasingly detached and, you know, executive producers attached to things. But you're still really involved in the
I can't do this. I've never started my own sort of production company or tried to. Occasionally... Once the BBC and once, you know, when I was freelance, I kind of oversaw other projects, but I can't do that thing of being half in, half out. When I left Veep after season four, because I sort of felt I'd taken it as far as I wanted to take it, and they said, you want to stay on as a consultant? I said, no, just just treat me as if I'm dead. Because I can't, you know, whoever's taking over it, Dave Mundell, who did a great job, he's got to feel he's in charge. And if I'm looking at it thinking, oh, maybe I could tweak that, or, you know, it would never...
It's not great for anyone, is it? Don't have the control you want, and nobody else wants you going, oh, well, I wouldn't have done it like that.
I'd be like the old retired Pope next door, just with a glass to the wall, just going, what's he up to now? What's this?
Tutting.
But ending celibacy for... What's going on? I wasn't expecting this.
Let's talk about your new project.
Yeah.
Avenue 5. Explain it.
It's set in 40 years' time.
Yeah.
When space tourism is much more achievable. And it's the maiden voyage of... There's a guy, Herman Judd, who owns these... He's made his fortune from holidays. And his now new big idea is holidays in space. And this is the maiden voyage of a sort of cruise ship round Saturn and back, 5,000 passengers, 1,500 crew. Normally takes 8 weeks. Something goes wrong. It could be at least 3 years before they get back. And so it's really just about putting a sort of pressure cooker in space of 6,500 people who have to start again, you know, have to decide between them how to get out of this.
The thing that struck me was my initial thought was, blimey, space is a departure from the sort of generally pretty sort of hyper-realistic stuff that you do. But actually, I've watched the first episode, it's really striking how Ryan Clark, the Hugh Laurie cat, who's the nominal captain of the ship, is essentially in the same mould as Nicola Murray in The Thick of It or Vice President in Veep, because it's just someone who everyone is looking to, and it turns out they're just a human being and they don't really know what they're doing either.
Yes, it turns out he's a literal fake. and because I wanted to capture this thing of, that thing that I think we all have, which is, I remember when we were researching In the Loop and we're going around Washington and somebody telling me that when Henry Kissinger started at the White House under Nixon, he'd spend the first year going, am I doing okay? Am I all right? Do you think he likes me? What do you think? Am I all right? And I thought, that's Henry Kissinger. I think we all have this ingrown fear of being found out, of fear that we're the one who's not pulling our weight. And I wanted to explore this, but also I think really pick up on something's been going on the last 4 or 5 years, the kind of the feeling of frenzy that's out there, you know, in the great human public. This air of dissatisfaction, but you can't quite put a word on it, you can't quite describe it, but a sense that something's about to blow, but we don't know what, and can we get... And also a sense of impending apocalypse that, you know, it's taken one 60-year-old girl to just point out and go, excuse me, but shouldn't we all be looking over there at that? And I wanted to pick up on that and do something with that, which is why I wanted to create this pressure cooker atmosphere where we can then examine, really, you know, how 6,500 people can come to terms with it and possibly get, you know, buy their way out.
It also sort of speaks to that feeling that otherwise intelligent adults have of just assuming there are some grown-ups in charge somewhere.
Yes.
And
yes,
someone knows what they're doing.
Yes.
And actually politics has shown me.
Yes. And
that
isn't that the kind of great revelation as you get older? I'm considerably older than you. But, you know, when you reach my age, you suddenly realise nobody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, you thought, you were taught as a child.
Exactly. That sort of deferential
thing. Various people, you know, doctors knew what they were doing. The church knew what it was doing. Government knew, the banks, the economists, they all sound like they know what they're talking about. And then as you get older, you realise, no, it's all based on calculated guesswork and human behaviour, really.
And how do you go about deciding, right, I want to do something set in space? I don't get the feeling that you're someone who sort of sits in the attic and toils at 3 a.m. How do you work? What's your process?
I used to be like that, but, you know, once you start having children, your sleep pattern is good. So I'm very much a kind of long days, but weekdays, and try and keep the weekends free and the evenings as much as possible. I've always been a sci-fi fan a space fan. I'm fascinated by space and space travel and the physics of it. I never really wanted to do a sci-fi that was full of aliens and laser guns and things like that, you know, because other people do that so well.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something that was set in space but just adhered to the laws of physics. In fact, Josh Gad, who plays Herman Judd, the kind of the moneyed owner of the ship, he plays someone who doesn't understand why he can't change the laws of physics by throwing money at it.
And did you put a lot of effort into making sure the physics were right?
Yeah, we went to, you know, Virgin Galactic in Mojave Desert and SpaceX in LA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and talked to the scientists there and the engineers and to get a sense of how it would work. And the thing that you find is that these ships will not have enormous amounts of fuel. It's all down to hitting angles at certain, you know, and swinging round certain moons and so on. That's the thing. Because just to get the sheer weight moving it fast enough, you can't carry lots of fuel, really. So it's about that. So, of course, in this program, where they miss a moon by, you know, 0.2% of a degree, that can mean the difference between 8 weeks and 3 years. I remember reading some story about NASA launched a satellite to Mars about 15 years ago, and it didn't land. It just skated over the atmosphere and shot off into space. And it's because somewhere along the line, someone in NASA had written a figure down as inches instead of centimeters.
Wow.
And that's enough, then led to $6 billion dollars worth of waste. Yeah.
And did they welcome you in, NASA, and Were they happy for you, knowing that you were probably going to be taking the mic?
But then I assured them I wanted to get it right rather than just invent these things. So I think they're quite keen to show you, you know, how they work it out. For me, it was quite thrilling to be in Mission Control and still see the signals coming in from Voyager. With the time, they had the time of voyage up, so it was like 40 years, 3 months, 2 days, you know, and the signals were still coming in from like outside the solar system. So I found that very exciting.
You didn't have to sneak in like you famously did with the
State Department. No, when I was in, we were researching in the loop and somebody told me, I said I wanted to get around the State Department. Somebody said, oh, just go to the reception and say you're from the BBC and you're here for the 12:30, which I did. And they just showed me in. I had a little BBC pass, but it was just a photograph of me with the words BBC next to it. I mean, it was like a child of three could have come up with it. And so I found myself wandering around the State Department taking photographs because I'm, you know, for research purposes. I thought, this is both kind of fun and also possibly international espionage. I don't know which. Then someone came up to me and went, excuse me? And I said, I'm here for the 12:30. He went, oh, it's just down there. And I went in and it was Condoleezza Rice's press briefing and it was very boring. But that, again, was that point as making you these buildings on the outside impress you, especially in Washington. They look very
huge and
like
intimidating.
Ancient Rome, marble pillars, temples of, like, perfection. And then you go in and you realise, no, it's lack security and nobody quite checking up on you.
And it's people sitting in boring meetings.
Very boring meetings, yeah. In the State Department, I discovered the chairs don't mask the desks because in America, they're very down on federal spending.
Yeah.
So they give these buildings, you know, as small a budget as possible. So they couldn't afford matching chairs and desks. So they bought cheap desks and then cheap chairs, the arms of which were too high. So you couldn't actually put your seat under the desk, you know. So you were actually sitting.
Everyone's too far
away from the desk, but it saved money. So that's what they're stuck with.
Did you ever get inside buildings in Whitehall when you were doing the thick of it?
Did I get inside? I have been round the Treasury. Yes, the Treasury and Ministry for Culture, Media and Sport. Yes. Very dull.
Yeah.
Very dull. Yes. As indeed is the West Wing. When you go around the West Wing, it's tiny, tiny corridors. It's like a rabbit warren. But people love to say that they work in the West Wing. So given the choice between that and a huge set of offices in another building, they'd rather. So you see these four-star generals in the West Wing sitting on a chair in a corridor with a laptop and their knee because they want to say they work in the West Wing.
Was there any part of you that thought that what's happening in politics on both sides of the Atlantic that made you want to do something that was pretty good break? The question that people listening to this podcast will be wanting me to ask is there any hope of you bringing back The Thick of It?
You see, the Thick of It worked on the basis that we knew what the conventions of politics were and therefore how to wander away from them. But if the conventions don't exist anymore or if they're being reinvented every day, it's very difficult to know what's abnormal.
Yeah.
And politicians are sort of inventing their own. They're subverting the rules of politics deliberately.
Yeah.
You know, Donald Trump is a kind of, you know, he'd call himself a disruptor, but he's also like an entertainer. He's a self-basting comic observation on his presidency.
Yeah.
And therefore, the comedians I find who are most adept at getting to the truth of what's going on act like journalists. So you've got John Oliver and his team of researchers and his archive troll and doing an actual polemic, an argument using factual extracts from speeches and research to mount both an argument and a kind of comic puncturing of that argument, you know. So it's like politicians have become comedians and comedians have become journalists. So, and journalists are now becoming politicians. Yeah. That's the other, you know, just so everyone's moved round one in that triangle. So, and everything is so feral at the moment and just changing shape constantly that I felt actually Avenue 5 is a sort of response to that in that I wanted to, okay, you sort of need to stand outside a bit, you know, to another time period and take this environment, not so much the political environment, but the social environment, the people, and look at how they're being affected by it.
Even just watching one episode of Avenue 5, the thing that strikes me when the credits come up is the number of people that you work with.
Yes.
Who you've worked with a lot before.
Yes.
Is that how you
like
to work?
I like to sort of always getting new people in and new writers in, but working with writers I've worked with before, working with people like Rebecca Front, who's in it, who I've worked with since On the Hour, really. Yeah. I like that. So that you're sort of building up a kind of repertory company of people that you can call upon, but you're always introducing new people, new directors, new writers, and new performers at the same time. I like that because it gives you with certain people, you have this shorthand already. You kind of know how you want to play it and so on. But also I like to be surprised. So I like bringing in new writers and new performers because I want to see something new as well, really. So I'm always refreshing it, but at the same time feeling familiar enough with what you've got that you can then start adapting it to something new.
You mentioned Rebecca Front. You obviously worked with her on The Hour. It's just a phenomenal alumni who've sort of spread out.
And
across.
It's like we kind of came together for the show. We weren't all at college together we came together for On the Hour. And we're still, working in groups of twos and threes. We're still all in touch with each other. And it pleases me that we sort of, we're still all in speaking terms.
The way that, were you sat there thinking everyone in this room is going to be a star? Did you think that you'd sort of struck gold?
I think we all thought there was something interesting about the show and that it was going in a place that we couldn't quite put a finger on with anything else that was on at the time. I don't think we had any notion that we were going to, I think we all thought, this guy's incredible. Steve Coogan. Yeah. I didn't really know him, but I was recommended, spoke to him. He did lots of voices and impressions at the time. But I was keen for him to like improvise. And when he improvised, it was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, and he's very quiet and softly spoken and he was slightly nervous, I think, when he arrived. And then he would get into these improvisations and they were like, and I'd end up broadcasting them almost unedited. And then the Alan Partridge character came very, very suddenly from that kind of atmosphere, that creative atmosphere. And that's an example of something that arrived kind of more or less fully formed. Alan Partridge, just like a click of fingers, this character. I just asked him to do a sports reporter, generic sports reporter. And I came out with this voice that was a sort of an amalgam of Motson and Coleman, but Gary Robertson on Today, probably. All of them in one. And somebody just said, he's a Partridge. And someone else said, yeah, and he's an Alan.
And that was it.
Just instant. He emerged like a foal. Kind of, you know how they're born and they just get up and start walking in a slightly kind of dizzy way. It was like that.
And where are you in your current sort of love-hate relationship with Alan Partridge? I know in the past you've talked about how making particularly a whole series was such a traumatic sort
it's
of
It's slightly wearing
experience.
Because you are spending the day, all day, every day with Alan Partridge in the room. Not with Steve. Steve is great, but with Alan. Because Alan's trope, as it were, is that he doesn't stop talking. You know, he has a voice for radio, which is you cannot allow dead air to occur. Dead air is a crime. So the method of writing is to just keep Alan, is to wind Alan up and fire new thoughts at him and just see what comes out. So you do spend about 8 hours of unfiltered Alan Partridge every day, which you might think is fun, but after three or four weeks of
a couple of months of that,
you are kind of chewing the furniture, really. So I think what we do with Alan is like, and he has lasted all these years, I think, because we didn't do one series and then do it again and again and again. We sort of took him out of his box every 4 or 5 years.
And reborn in a slightly different environment.
And then he'd aged in real time.
Yeah.
So, he had grown in his opinions or matured or immatured, depending on how you look at it. So he becomes different every time. And Steve is always like 10 years behind Alan in age. But over the years,
he's caught up.
Begins to look like he's caught up.
If you go back to On the Hour, which of that incredible group of talent, they've gone off and done stuff, which of their projects would you most like to, which they've done without you, would you most like to have done?
Heavens, that's an interesting one. I mean, I loved Chris Morris's Jam and Blue Jam, actually. I thought that was so, it was almost like, it was just like rewriting the rules again.
Yeah.
It was like, yes, I'm going to do these slightly provocatively dark subjects, turn them into sketches, but then perform them like they weren't even comedy, perform them slowly and with music and almost like defy you to laugh. And yet the more defiant it is, the funnier it becomes.
Yeah.
That for me, I think was the most original and most impressive thing. I think I would have spoiled it, to be honest.
Because you'd have worried all the viewers might not like this.
I'd have thought, oh, if you could get another joke in if you sped it up a bit, you know.
Get a whole new sketch in at the end.
It needs a punchline. No.
And what about, do you think, because it was quite a long time ago that was on.
Yes. Yeah.
There's not been anything like that. I mean, a lot of TV comedy now is quite old fashioned, you know, the stuff which is, you know, big on BBC One type.
Yeah, but you look at stuff like, well, I'm a big fan of This Country. Yeah. You look at This Country, which ostensibly might be a mockumentary. Yes, we've seen that before. But again, the scenes, you know, the writing is such that it dares to be full of non sequiturs. It dares to take you down routes that you weren't expecting. It dares to not have a kind of neatly written ending. It dares to be messy, really, and unpredictable, which I like.
Because actually that's more real than a normal.
Exactly, yeah. And yet it's funny. You know, it's not boring because it's real. Yeah. It's hilarious because it's real.
Yeah. Okay, still to come, I'll ask Armando about creating Omnishambles, which was then used by politicians, and what he really thinks of Dominic Cummings. We'll be back after this short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What are you working on at the moment? Because you've got Avenue 5, you've also got...
I've got David Copperfield
coming out this week as well.
I know. It's like these films... So David Copperfield was made 2 summers ago and Avenue 5 was made last summer. But like, you know how when you sometimes hear of two cruise ships banging into each other and you think, how in the whole of the Pacific both of you bump into each other? That's happened.
That's happened
and
to
both
you.
Of these things are coming out this week. So I'm kind of slightly confused, slightly dazed and confused as to what I'm saying at any one time.
You can just talk about Hugh Laurie, can't you? Because he's in both.
He's in both, yes. Daisy May Cooper is in both.
Yeah.
Who else is in both? Nikki McBride's in both, yeah. So yes, Personal History of David Copperfield comes out, which I'm really, I can't wait for it to come out actually, because I'm very, very pleased with what we come out. I'm a huge fan of Charles Dickens. And I've always thought he's very funny, and yet we have him down as this gloomy kind of Victorian, you know, dark, muddy, cobbled streets and child vagrants and, you know, and yes, there is all that, but there's lots of really funny stuff in it.
It struck me having seen the trailer and thought, that's just some made up. I hadn't realised it is the proper story.
Oh, yeah,
if you go dialogue.
Into the book, there's a great scene... They never get shown in any adaptation of when David gets drunk for the first time and he just describes the whole of London swirling in front of him. And it's like that scene in The Wolf of Wall Street when they're kind of crawling along the floor. He describes him crawling up the stairs because he can't stand up. Or he describes falling in love with Dora, his first girlfriend, and being so besotted by that he sees her name in the clouds and everywhere he goes. On the side of an omnibus, he sees the word Dora. And it's all quite surreal, but none of that is in the adaptations.
Sort of, yeah, sort of tea time Sunday drama.
I think they go for the plot, and actually it's not, it's about the language and the characters and the great kind of imagery and the one-liners as well.
Yeah. There's a lot of, obviously, language from Dickens which just sort of enters the national vocabulary, but you've done quite a bit of that. I mean, Omnishambles is a...
Well, I'll
prime example.
I'll credit that to Tony Roach, one of our writers who came up with that. But yes, it sort of, I think that's the point where I stopped doing the thick of it, when it entered the OED, and also when the likes of Cameron and Ed Miliband at the time were quoting it at Question Time. I sort of thought, no,
stop it. You're not
stop it. This is meant to make you feel awful, not to be a kind of aspirational guidebook.
And there is something about, in particular, I think the last couple of years, that politics has been so mad that people have used, having seen the tick of it, as a sort of reference point for sort of thinking, well, yes, you know, quiet back people isn't a million miles away from Brexit means Brexit. You know, the sort
yes,
of,
you yes.
could, somebody in a room has had to come
squeezed
up with something.
Squeezed middle. Do you
squeezed
remember
middle
Nick Clegg's
Alarm Clock Britain,
the squeezed middle?
Yeah.
You know, and you know that there's a group of people all aged about 20 sitting in a room writing these down and trying them out. Some of them are taking bets as to whether a minister will say them or not. I know this. I know this.
There was a story, wasn't there, that Theresa May said something in the House of Commons, or got
yes.
based only on a bet.
Yes. Yeah, she didn't know it.
Yes, there was like tea at the Ritz or something.
Something like that, yes. Stake. One of these punchlines that she did so well. I once, on the Friday night, no, the election night armistice, on the 1997 election, David Schneider, Peter Bainham and I did this thing of we made a stand-up act out of politicians' jokes. One Tory, that was me, yep. One Labour, I think that was David, and one Lib Dem, Peter, and performed them at comedy gigs. But as our own material, we didn't say that they were actually...
But they were genuine...
Stolen from... Yeah. Jokes. And then we filmed the gigs dying. And I mean, it was dreadful. It was great telly. It was horrible because it was like knowing that we were going to go out and get announced as ourselves, but we'll then tell terrible jokes.
It was that an idea which seemed much better in the room you came up with it rather than just before you're about to go on.
Yeah, I mean, it was great watching it back because obviously the audience reactions were amazing. But yes, we hadn't thought through that we would then have to do it. And it was horrible. You know, it's dreadful standing up on stage at the Comedy Store telling jokes
knowing
by Conservatives.
At least if you go on thinking I've got some good stuff and it doesn't work, that's quite bad.
But if you go on thinking I've got some dreadful stuff and I'm about to say it as me, yeah.
Do you look across politics and think there's anyone who gives you any hope as a citizen rather than as a comedian?
Well, I kind of liked it when... I mean, they've all been defeated or left politics now. There was something kind of slightly admirable about the last parliament and these defiant ones, people defying their parties on the left and the right, I thought was quite good. And also, you know, I write this stuff because I'm, you know, I like politics. I want it to be good, you know, and I think everyone does. And the stuff I write or make is made out of frustration, I think, rather than, or anger at things like, I mean, think of it emerged after the war in Iraq, because I just wanted to look at how did a decision like that get made when everyone was saying, this is ridiculous, don't do this. So I wanted to look at just the process of where power lies in Westminster and how it... And the key is, surprise, surprise, if you are a prime minister with a big majority, you can do anything you like in the UK. You know, we have a very unfettered system here. We don't have checks and balances. We had them in the last parliament because the prime minister didn't have a majority. Yeah. But once a prime minister has majority, you know, Boris Johnson can get rid of the Supreme Court if he wants.
Yeah.
You know, he may well do.
Move
the House of Lords. You know, you can do what the hell you like. And in a way that you can't actually do if you're the French president or even the American president. You know, there are checks and balances there that we actually don't have.
It's strange how we've gone sort of full circle in that 15 years from New Labour's, you know, big majorities can do what they like.
Yes.
The opposition is a sort of a bit of a joke. And we're suddenly, having thought that politics was going to be mad forever, we seem to have ended up back there.
We're in a strange situation, though, because it's still a coalition of sorts, because it is this coalition with the North who don't normally vote Conservative. And it'd be interesting to see how the government will play that out. I don't think they can play as naturally to their default of minimum government, minimum interference, minimum size of the state, reduce, pull back. It's already, the language is changing. It's about inclusivity. It's about involving the state and the state involved. You know, it's about a kind of involvement in people's lives. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out.
It'll be interesting as well to see how the Labour Party reacts to it.
Yes.
The Tories aren't all cutting evil put everyone in the workhouse type tourists, then how do they play off against
them? Well, there's now an interesting debate going on in the Labour leadership, which probably should have happened about 5 years ago, as to what Labour is for. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
And just finally, what about Dominic Cummings? He feels like a character that even you'd have slightly balked at creating.
I know we had Stuart Pearson, who was based on the sort of an element of Steve Hilton and an element of the sort of think tank guru type, should never be taken out of the box and put in charge of a department type individuals. Well, exactly. I mean, he is his own, again, he's his own parody. I mean, that blog post recently is like indecipherable gobbledygook. But you laugh, but he's running the country.
You laugh up until that bit.
He is actually running the country. So now what?
Yeah, you can email his Gmail account or whatever it is and ask for a job. That's the best you can do.
Yeah, maybe I should apply.
Have you ever, when doing any of your sort of political projects, thought, maybe I should have a go at, you know, rather than just taking the mic? Is entering politics ever crossed your mind?
No, I mean, it's the whole party thing that I'm not sure I could stomach, because I don't like the idea of being labelled, but I also don't like the idea of signing up to, you know, a set of policies, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't. It's like going into management at the BBC, which I did very, very briefly, having to defend programmes, which I knew I didn't like. You know? I soon got out, and I think I'd come unstuck
so
pretty
soon.
If you
could go straight in as sort of president and supreme over, it would be okay. But the rise is the
One of these things where, you know, voted in by acclamation rather than by getting the public to make a decision.
I can speak to you for ages, but I think unfortunately we've run out of time. I should just say that Avenue 5, episode 1 is already available to watch on Now TV, and the rest of the season is on Sky One, and The Personal History of David Copperfield is in cinemas this week as well. Armando Iannucci, it's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Acast, Spotify, wherever you listen, and sign up to my morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners, so there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.